Okay, welcome back. Thanks. Rather than introducing the ambiguities of the notion of hallucinating a canon, I just trust that each of the following presentations will exhibit a version of it and be lucid on its own terms, and like to straight introduce Tom Holert, who is an art historian, writer, curator, artist, living in Berlin, and together we're preparing an exhibition in part of the Kanonfragen on Karl Einstein. Tom has published numerous books, one of the latest called Übergriffe, Zustände und Zuständigkeiten der zeitgenössischen Kunst, and used to teach at the Academy of Vienna, currently part teaching at the Berlin FU University. Welcome, Tom. Kanon as Decomposition, Karl Einstein's Renegade Modernism.
Thank you, Anselm. I want to join my fellow speakers in thanking Anselm, Paz, and the whole team of the HKW for having me here. And I'm actually quite excited to, because this is my first public foray into the world of Karl Einstein scholarship. I'm not an expert, I'm coming from a little bit from the sidelines, but I've always been passionate about this writer and thinker, and I was super glad when Anselm asked me if I would be interested in joining him, collaborating with him in preparing and actually realizing this project, which is scheduled for the late 2017. In October, I'll start right away. In October 2015, The Exalted, a new one-hour performance written by playwright, poet, singer, essayist, theater director, etc., Carl Hancock Rux, and directed by Anne Bogart, premiered at the BAM Next Wave Festival in New York. Beautiful, enigmatic, and almost entirely opaque, a New York Times critic writes about the event, The Exalted centers on Karl Einstein, a German-Jewish art historian who killed himself while trying to escape occupied France in 1940. Karl Hancock Rux, the review continues, dressed in a cap, suspenders, and baggy breeches, narrates the end of Einstein's life as the avant-garde composer Theo Blackman acts out his final moments. Einstein's final moments. There are also excerpts from Einstein's lectures on African art. There haven't been lectures on African art by Einstein, to my knowledge. Songs created live with the sound of the reviewer is referring to books or text essays Einstein wrote on African art. Songs created live with the sound of Mr. Blackman's own breath. A brief summary of the Namibian genocide by German troops in the early 20th century, some ancillary video, and a charming rendition of Lili Marleen. However, in the critic's eye, these aspects never cohere, nor does the incoherence seem especially purposeful or illuminating. The suffering of individuals and states and the unexpected revelation of beauty might be the governing themes. They might not. The performance seems the sort of thing that is perfectly intelligible to those involved, but baffling to anyone less in the know. Several times the review ends, Mr. Rux repeats a quotation from Einstein describing the act of making art as a blend of cruelty and assassination. Maybe so, but here at least it includes a hefty portion of perplexity too, end of quote. To readers of Karl Einstein's writings, this review may sound, and the kind of tone of the review may sound somewhat familiar. Perplexity certainly is one mode of reaction easily elicited by Einstein's rapid-fire, often repetitious, highly condensed, packed, neologistic, opinionated essays, articles, poems, plays, and books. To base a performance on Einstein's biography and intellectual production can hardly prevent to become a super dense and therefore potentially opaque affair. As already intimated in the New York Times review, Einstein led a tumultuous, even desperate, and ultimately tragic life, a young Jewish poet close to the German Expressionist movement around the journal Die Aktion in the pre-First World War years, who by the age of 27 published his novel Bebouquin oder Die Dilettanten des Wunders in 1912. He survived the war, worked in the colonial department of the Brussels Civil Administration, where he had access to the library of the infamous Africa Museum in Tervuren, became active in the Soldiers' Council in Belgium in 1918, returned to Germany to join the November Revolution and the Spartakusbund, held a speech at Rosa Luxemburg's funeral in June 1919, collaborated with Wieland Herzfelde, George Gross, Paul Westheim, Alfred Flechtheim, and others in numerous publishing endeavors, caused a scandal with his blasphemous theater piece Die Schlimme Botschaft, authored the last volume of the legendary 24-volume Propyläen Kunstgeschichte on the art of the 20th century, Die Kunst des 20. Jahrhunderts, the first edition of which was published in 1926, much more on this soon, moved from Berlin to Paris in 1928, where he founded in 1929, together with Georges Bataille and Georges Wildenstein, the surrealist magazine Document, Doctrine, Archéologie, Beaux-Arts, Ethnographie, wrote a complex monograph on Georges Braque, who was also his best man at his wedding in 1934, I think, that was published in French in the same year, 1934, went with his wife, Luda Gouefriquian, to Spain in 1936 to join the anarcho-syndicalist CNT-FAI, the Confederación Nacional del Trabajo, Federación Anarquista Ibérica, and the Grupo Internacional of the Ratti Column at the Aragon Front of the Civil War, where he was soon elected Técnico de Guerra. In 1939, Einstein returned to France, where he was detained as a German citizen, escaped the German occupation of Paris during the fall of France, and fled to the south, where he was left trapped on the French border with Franco-Spain. On July 5, 1940, Einstein committed suicide in the Pyrenees town of L'Estelle-Bétarame. Particularly interested in the circumstances of Einstein's death, that was arguably caused by the loss of any possibility to belong to a nation or a nation state, by a stateless existence with all the life-threatening dangers this implies, Carl Hancock Rux capitalizes on the complexities of this intellectual's and activist's biography, as well as the very complexities that Einstein's ventures into African art and European modernism, into ethnography and psychology, provide for Rux's poetic political project. In Rux's own words, The Exalted sets out to untangle, I quote, knots of heritage, art, and atrocity to reconsider the price of freedom and self-preservation. The photograph promoting the evening shows Rux and Blackman standing opposite to each other while facing the camera with questioning, or if you will, self-asserting gazes. Blackman, who among other roles plays the character of Carl Einstein in the piece, holds a mask, probably of African origin, but who knows, it could also be produced somewhere else, only meant to look like an African mask. He holds the mask in a way as if he wants to latch it onto the face of its authors, Carl Hancock Rux, a gesture that seems to be about forcing an identity onto someone, as if to emphasize the Africanness of the African-American artist, who is in fact partly of German origin, as his great-grandfather was German, hence the name Karl, hence Rux's interest in Afro-Germanness, hence his interest in the history of Germany's relation to Africa, to Germany's colonialist past and present, and to German culture's conceptions of African culture, and hence his long-time interest in the figure of the other Karl, Karl Einstein. In the performance's thematic context, the obvious reference of the mask gesture is Einstein's slim 1915 volume Negerplastik, the cover of which is conspicuously featuring a mask, as well as Einstein's continuing interest in African art and culture and the pursuit of a revisionist ethnographic account of art and primitivism throughout his work. In the course of The Exalted, Rux and Blackman act and read in front of projected translations from Einstein's text. Here you see the two standing with their back to a quote from the first page of Negerplastik, where Einstein, in his typical sharp-edged polemical prose, positions himself against the racist and colonialist denigrating attitude towards African art based on quote, vague evolutionary hypothesis and a spurious concept of the primitive, recht vagen Evolutionshypothesen und einem Fehlbegriff von Primitivität. In the final chapter of the book, Einstein develops a short theory of the masks as an instrument of depersonalization and metamorphosis. Other than the psychologizing and at the same time theatrical European, the African in Einstein's terms, is prepared to transform him or herself, particularly in states of trance and ecstasy. Through the mask, a metamorphosis can take place, the abandoning of subjectivity in favor of an incarnation of the objective. Therefore, Einstein writes, the mask only makes sense when it is inhuman, non-personal, that is, constructive, free of the experiences of the individual. The fixedness or rigidity, the stupor of the African face masks is, I quote, nothing else than the final intensity of expression freed from any psychological becoming, with a tendency towards an ambivalent indifference of the psychological expression, fusing the physiognomic expressions of contradictory sensations. To a certain extent, Carl Hancock Rux and Theo Blackman demonstrate or test the validity of these claims. Somewhat undecided, they seem to ponder if the mask should be put on or not, whether it is ultimately stabilizing, fixing, or destabilizing, unfixing identity and personality. Bringing Carl Einstein to the stage in a performance written by a contemporary artist working quite deliberately on issues of African-American and Afro-German identity in an attempt to engage with multiple entangled histories and traumata in the present-day context of increased racism as well as anti-racist campaigns such as Black Lives Matter, both activates and actualizes Einstein's biography and writing. Furthermore, it participates in a process of canonization. For without a doubt, Einstein has become a sort of canonical figure during the past decade or so, even if he is still known by only a few initiated. By now, he is, in some areas or some realms of academia at least, is being ranked regularly among other heroes of early 20th century European intellectual history, such as Walter Benjamin, Sigurd Karkauer, Abi Warburg, or Rudolf Arnheim. Though the rediscovery of Einstein began in West Germany in the 1960s and 1970s with important research and editorial work done by Sibylle Penkert and Heidemarie Oehm, the founding of the Carl Einstein Gesellschaft in 1984, the philological work by Liliane Meffre or Klaus H. Kiefer, and last not least by the addition of Einstein's collected writings, by now comprising 5 volumes between 1980 and 1996, provided a fairly comprehensive scholarly apparatus around the work. The breakthrough, particularly on an international level, had to wait until the 2000s, when October in 2004 published an issue dedicated to Einstein, when Uwe Fleckner presented his monumental monograph in 2006, followed by an exhibition on Einstein Fleckner curated at the Reina Sofia in Madrid in 2008 and 2009, accompanied by a catalog in Spanish and English. When David Quigley, in the same year, 2006, published his dissertation, Carl Einstein, A Defense of the Real. When in 2011, the Musée de Quai Branly published an anthology on Carl Einstein et le primitivisme. And when just recently, Sebastian Zeitler collected his long-standing research on Einstein into the 2016 form as Revolt. The growing interest in Einstein's multi-scalar transdisciplinary practice, however, shall interest me here mainly as a contemporary context or scholarly framework that navigates, organizes, and affects the ongoing encounters with a work that in itself displays a highly peculiar, ambivalent relationship to the very acts and politics of canonization. In his lifetime, Einstein was considered a difficult, redundant, flamboyant, anti-didactic, and polarizing theorist of art, someone whose authority was based not only on his apparent knowledge and erudition, but even more on his reputation of being relentless, incomprehensible at times, obscure and daring, that is, not at all academic and disciplined. Nonetheless, he was commissioned in 1922 by Propyläen Kunstverlag, an imprint of the Berlin publisher Ullstein, to conceive and to write the canonical book in German language on contemporary art. The Popelian History of Art project, published in 24 volumes between 1923 and 1944, here 17 of those volumes, arguably embodied the canon, the canonical, like hardly any other publishing endeavor on the arts at the time. It was understood as the key authoritative compendium of knowledge on world art history, written by leading and institutionally embedded protagonists from the German museum and university field, such as Wilhelm von Bode, Gustav Pauli, or Max Friedländer. The volumes not only were conceived as interventions in the various subdisciplines of museology, art history, Renaissance studies, design history, Kunstwissenschaft, aesthetics, etc., but also as guidebooks for potential art buyers and collectors, and this not only nationally. For instance, an article in the Chicago Sunday Times Tribune from January 1931 claimed that noted contemporary art collectors have based their collections on the theories they found in Einstein's Kunst des 20. Jahrhunderts, which you see here. However, the same article emphasizes that Einstein, while his opinion is sought by dealers and connoisseurs in all the countries of Europe, has always remained strictly aloof from anything even remotely resembling commercial exploitation of his expert knowledge. So much about the economics of canon production and the individual strategies to resist their seductions. By choosing Einstein, Popelian and Ullstein had obviously looked for a writer that would be able to compete on a par with the most discussed theorists of modern and contemporary art in German language, such as Julius Meyer-Graefe and Wilhelm Hausenstein. Meyer-Graefe's Entwicklungsgeschichte der modernen Kunst, published in three volumes for the first time in 1904, and two volumes for the first time in 1904, saw three more editions until 1924, the last one in three volumes. Addressed at the Lichtmenschen, the light or enlightened people of the early 20th century, it defined Impressionism as the ultimate peak in modern art's development, equated it with modern art per se, and historicized it. By constructing an evolutionary and competitive Darwinist and anti-academic history of Impressionism as a specific artistic mode operating amidst the history of the visual arts as such, Meyer-Graefe's teleological model indeed aspired to become a canon architecture. He even used architectonic metaphors such as the one of the four pillars of modern art, die vier Säulen der modernen Malerei, Manet, Renoir, Degas, and Cézanne. The influence of Meyer-Graefe's writings and his evolutionary historicist model on the 1906 centennial exhibition of German art, Deutsche Jahrhundertausstellung, the Deutsche Jahrhundertausstellung, by the way, designed the publications and the exhibition design by Peter Behrens, which completely revised the history of 19th century painting and become one of the most canonical events in European early 20th century modernism, cannot be underestimated and was a sort of touchstone of every canonizing endeavor that would follow it in the 20th century. However, Meyer-Graefe's evolutionary model of the rise and decline of the impressionistic mode proved to be inappropriate where it came to take into account the avant-garde ruptures before, during, and after the First World War. The canonicity of his model that was based on a pessimistic view of the state of contemporary art and culture failed in the face of the epistemological breaks entailed by expressionism, cubism, dada, etc. Like Meyer-Graefe and Einstein, Wilhelm Hausenstein worked as a freelance writer. Interestingly, all three never occupied official positions in the institutions of the art world or the academy. Moreover, all three practiced as literary writers. The production of the canon of modern art, it seems, had to happen in the often precarious, dubious independence of the free agent competing on the publishing and art markets. Like Einstein, who was 2 years his junior, Hausenstein belonged to the post-Meyer-Graefe generation, had a strong interest in non-European arts. He wrote a rather favorable review of Einstein's Negerplastik in 1915 and became an ardent partisan of expressionism, which for him was the epitome of zeitgenössische Kunst, contemporary art. Hausenstein was a popular, widely read counterpart for Einstein and his theory of art, who emphatically, as the titles of his 1914 Die bildende Kunst der Gegenwart, Contemporary Visual Art, and his 1920 Die Kunst in diesem Augenblick, The Art of This Very Moment, already suggest, tried to be off and in the now of contemporary art production. Originally asked to organize his contribution around the most recent art, Die jüngste Kunst, Expressionism, as it reads in the first draft contract with Propylaen Ullstein, Einstein embarked between 1922 and 1926 on a research and writing process that would lead him to encompass the various European modernist tendencies following Impressionism, focusing on painting and here namely on Cubism and German Expressionism. The roughly 170 print pages of text of the first edition, published in 1926, were followed by almost 400 pages of illustrations, the most comprehensive collection of reproductions of early 20th century painting and sculpture available at the time. Only L. Lisitsky's and Jean Arp's slim 1925 Die Kunstismen may be compared with Die Kunst des 20. Jahrhunderts in its ambition, though certainly not in its scope and scale. The sheer physical weight of the book was even used as a weapon against its author when the sculptor Ernesto De Fiori, who felt grossly misrepresented by Einstein, hit the critic on his head in 1926 with the volume, an attack that caused quite a buzz in the Berlin papers of the time. Indeed, in his critical appraisals, Einstein did not take any prisoners. The judgments on his contemporaries, among them many close friends like George Grosz or De Fiori, but also artists such as Kandinsky or Beckmann, are often cruel and unforgiving. The abrasive, harsh manner may and should be seen as a result of the urgency that Einstein sought after in the objects of his scrutiny. He quickly gets impatient with any artistic practice that doesn't commit itself to the radical overhaul of the ways in which pictures are being made and looked at, that doesn't work towards an extension and reconfiguration, a recomposition of the senses themselves in accordance with and in response to the continuous mechanization and industrialization of perception in capitalist and communist societies. Die Kunst des 20. Jahrhunderts saw two further editions, both of which, particularly the third one and third and last one from 1931, were strongly revised by Einstein. He considerably extended the sections on Cubism and added a section on Surrealism, which he called Romanticism, as well as on Paul Klee, and included a lot of new plates and illustrations of works produced between 1926 and 1931, most importantly by Picasso, Braque, Léger, Klee, Miró, and André Masson, which would define his pillars or his canon, whose Masson's automatic drawings assumed an emblematic function for Einstein's conceptions of the very assassination and cruelty quoted by Karl Hancock Rux in The Exalted. To provide an idea of the sense of urgency that Einstein makes tangible in this book that oozes authority in very different registers, I propose to compare the first page of the introductions in the 1926 and 1931 editions, an introduction that Einstein titled Vorbedingungen, Preconditions. In these brief accounts of the disruption of the classicist academic order of 19th century naturalism and impressionism, the insurgency against the schematic, modulary approach to painting, against epigonism, against the usual image fabrication, die übliche Bilderfabrikation, was called revolt. Here, Revolte. In the 26 edition, whereas he changed the term to Aufruhr, turmoil or upheaval in the 1931 edition. This edit may be read as a slight nuance shift from a political to a psychological semantics. It would thus parallel the changes at the beginning of the first paragraph, where Einstein in the 26 edition speaks of the new painterly experiences, the neue malerischen Erfahrungen, Erlebnissen, here, that caused the breakdown of the academic beauty industry, whereas in the 1931 edition he uses the expression other or hidden experiences, anderen oder verborgenen Erfahrungen, thereby cutting the new and the painterly in order to direct the attention towards a deeper psychological or anthropological dimension that he held responsible for the crisis of the old system. Thusly adjusting, fine-tuning, and ultimately changing his argument within a time span of 5 years, Einstein also performs his canonizing project, which is anyway based on assumptions of the anti-canonicity of any relevant artistic practice, as a project of constant modification and modulation in an asymptotic argumentative movement towards ever higher degrees of analytic precision and description with regard to the role that art is supposed to play in a social, economic, political, and collective psychological situation which inevitably veers towards collapse. The publisher, on his part, advertised the new editions by emphasizing the book's importance as the major source of names and images. At the occasion of the second 1928 edition, Die Kunst des 20. Jahrhunderts is hailed as the first ever attempt to bring clarity in the chaos of the art of our time, to distinguish the valuable from the valueless, while using Paul Klee's 25, Die Erfinderin des Nests, The Inventress of the Nest, as visual evidence. The copytext of the 1931 ad is limited to a list of names and the assurance that the work is in fact leading right until our days. Almost every newly emerged artist's name of importance is to be found here, accompanied by a reason that is 1930 still life by Georges Braque. In many ways, these attempts at creating publicity ran counter to Einstein's intentions. Decidedly not pursuing a project of completeness or newness as such, simply filling in the gaps entailed by the course of time that passed between each edition with names, and also not searching any Apollinic clarity in the contemporary art's chaos, Einstein used the stage that the Popelian Kunstgeschichte endeavor opened to him to place a Trojan horse before the public. The format of the encyclopedic handbook serves as the respectable ambience for a project of redefining, indeed recomposing, the ways in which the visual arts are being conceived and their historical meaning and immanent hierarchy of value and esteem narrated. For what Einstein proposes as an argument to be increasingly elaborated in the course of the three editions of Die Kunst des 20. Jahrhunderts is a non-linear, transhistorical, and, using a term coined in his notes for a handbook of art from the 1930s, transvisual conception of art. Most significantly developed in the years after he left Berlin for Paris in 1928 to escape the increasingly repressive atmosphere in Weimar Republic Berlin and to collaborate with Georges Bataille, Michel Leiris, and others on the Surrealist document endeavor, Einstein's theory of cubism and post-cubist tendencies, his ethnographic interests, and his rather devastating, self-depreciating analysis of intellectual culture and society at large in the late 20s and 30s converged into a bundle, into a cluster of arguments around the necessity to irrationalize art, to understand the most advanced practices such as Picasso's, Braque's, Masson's, or Klee's in the late 20s and early 30s as a new and free mythic way of looking, to acknowledge the collapse of subject-object divisions and the utmost importance of hallucination, the hallucinative aspect or hallucinative interval that disconnects the reality of the artwork from the external reality as well as the unconscious from the conscious, being as a new reign of the irrational and illogic in the making and the reception of art that has abandoned every representational relation and become the energetic force field of post-anthropomorphic recreation, and finally to admit to the inevitable process of primitivization that is due thanks to the failure of what Einstein called the liberal pluralism of realities. From Einstein's vantage point in the early 1930s, when he was revising Die Kunst des 20. Jahrhunderts, preparing and writing his book on Georges Braque, and probably starting to work on the draft of Die Fabrikation der Fiktion, a furious attack on contemporary culture and an embittered exercise in self-cancellation, the technological and economic developments of the past decades have forever discredited the idea of the individual self of personality. The aktuelle Kunst, therefore, if it is actually to be qualified as contemporary, has to convey the hidden layers, the transpersonal and transhistorical energy fields, has to support and accelerate the crisis and the collapse of occidental subjectivity. Each hallucination, Einstein claims, by necessity is of a general collective order. It is in the dissociation, Abspaltung, that collective forces and forms are being aroused and used unconsciously and prophetically. The role of art in these processes, however, becomes increasingly problematic. As artworks turn out to be petrifications of experiences, they are conservative, notwithstanding their revolutionary gesture. This is Einstein in 1930 in France. And he was on a trip with Léger and a collector there. And some months later, on February 16, 1931, Einstein was invited by Karl Glaser to speak at the Berliner Staatliche Kunstbibliothek at Prinz Albrecht Street, today Niederkirchner Straße. The building of the Kunstbibliothek was next to the Martin Gropius Bau, and which is, as we all know today, the site of the Topography of Terror exhibition. In a series of six lectures entitled The Problems of Painting Today, Glaser, a prolific writer, historian, and curator, was the director of the rather progressive Kunstbibliothek and soon to be dismissed from his post by the Nazis. And probably aware of the fact that Einstein's heavily revised third edition of Die Kunst des 20. Jahrhunderts, which was due to appear later in the same year. In a short reviewing note on the lecture in the journal Weltkunst, maybe by Glaser himself, Einstein is portrayed as a lecturer who keeps steady contact with the audience, that in turn was vividly taking position against and in favor of the ideas he put forward. The draft of the talk has survived in the Einstein archive at the Akademie der Künste here in Berlin. It is an astonishingly accessible text surveying his theory at exactly this crucial turning point around, say, 28 and 32. In an important moment of the lecture, Einstein speaks of the dreams as being as disconnected from the daily life as are the hallucinations from which the pictures by Masson, Arp, Miró, Picasso, Klee, and others have emerged that he will be showing at a later stage of the talk. A state of trance is to be sought that in turn necessitates the erasure of any memory of the factual in order to pave the way into an inner world. After a long reflection on the force of symbols in primitive rituals and the urge to distance oneself from the external objects in trance and ecstasy, he dwells on the position of the human in the new art, which is one of passive affection, of sheer instrumentality, of submission to hallucination, like in archaic rituals, until the point where the I, the ego, is extinguished. Since pictures, and Einstein speaks of Bilder, not of paintings, are psychic compressions, seelische Stauung, that operate by reducing the relation to reality, not by affirming it. Towards the end of the 1931 Berlin lecture, Einstein asks himself and the audience why, considering this, the dissociations, extinctions, and cutoffs between subject and object, inner and outer reality, which are characteristic of the new art that he is promoting, it is still possible at all to relate to the pictures he has shown slides of, many of which probably of the order of this 1930 Masson, which he included in the 1931 edition of Die Kunst des 20. Jahrhunderts. His answer: Because they are projections of our own bodies, the various parts of which are being allocated according to symbolic accents. The psychographic processes in the automatic drawings of Masson thus are comparable with the primitive projection of a human being into a totem. Like the tribal primitive artwork is conceived of in the cult ritual as a living corpse, Einstein informed the audience at the Kunstbibliothek, the recent pictures by Masson, Klee, Miró, or Picasso are to be understood as the vessels of our dead energies and hallucinations. Finally, he released the audience with another intriguing question. He asked, where do these pictures end? That is, where do they find their limit time, their Grenzzeit? The totality of images, Bildtotalität, Einstein said, he believes, is only a symptom of exhaustion, and every intensification of sensation may ultimately result in a feeling of limits, in a Gefühl von Grenzen. The history of limits and the issue of canonicity could thus be radicalized and reoriented through Einstein's vision of a limit time, of the potential end of the very possibility of pictures in a world of mechanized, or today algorithmized, experience, of a utopian pessimism whose tectonics, as Einstein would say, will certainly not guarantee any solace from fear of death. And as Carl Hancock Rux eloquently elaborates in his performance on Einstein's deprivation of citizenship, the nationless dystopia of exile in the 1930s and 40s, where belonging for so many was suspended, not only Einstein's counter-canonical work lost its grounding, as it was bereft of any context based on a shared language, moreover, the hope to be absorbed as the lone intellectual in the great social process of socialist redistribution died in the Spanish Civil War. The very base of livelihood simply vanished. The tectonics to keep death at bay did not hold. Nowhere to turn anymore. The very Europe that he tried to make his home. He, who had theorized the radicalization of imagination as hallucination, as ultimately suicidal, these are his words, killed himself. Thank you.